You're listening to Across the Tracks, a Route 66 story.
Tom T.
Along comes World War II, and another generation of soldiers comes home from another war in Europe, and they'd seen the beginnings of the Autobahn. And in those days, and for many years, there was still a lot of fear in this country about the possibility of America being invaded by a foreign power. And we wanted to have the kind of road system that it would take to support us in a land war in America, and that's what inspired the Interstate Defense Highway Act.
After the war, business accelerated. Pumped up by the post-war economy, Americans had money, new cars, and wanted to hit the road, as Stanley Marsh, an artist in Amarillo, Texas, recalls.
We won the war, and it was our right to have those big cars, and we had the gas right here in Texas, and we had the right to be optimistic and want to break the bank in Las Vegas and be movie stars.
Young songwriter Bobby Troup set out on the road to seek his fortune in Hollywood and made it on Route 66 instead by turning the highway into a public icon.
I want to tell a musical story about a trip west. Yeah. And so I just included all the cities, trying to make them singable. I had no idea that it would become what it's become. You go through St. Louis, Joplin, Missouri, and Oklahoma City, looks mighty
good. Get your kicks on Route 66.
When he arrived at the end of Route 66, he met Nat King Cole, who had a big hit with the song.
I'd met him through a man named Bullets Durgan, who had been with Tommy Dorsey. We went to see Nat. That's what I thought to myself. How often would you ever get an opportunity like this, Bobby, to play for Nat King Cole? You got to think of something, something. I often write songs in the car, and I wrote a song about my trip in the car. I hadn't finished it, but I wrote half the song. So I played If You Ever Planned a Motor West, and he loved it.
Route 66 will never die. I mean, to me,
Ry Cooder,
if you were to say, let's name a dozen or so of the greatest American songs, I'm going to include that song because it does everything a song should do. It rocks like mad. It's fast, moving. It's got action in it. It's very hard to write a song in which the lyrics and the tempo and the melody move you. They actually give you a sense of going. First and greatest thing about the song is that you feel like you're in the car. I'm thinking of like about a metallic lime green 53 Cadillac with the big motor and the leather seats, and you're doing this. And then he hits all the places, you know, along the way, and he makes it rhyme.
Get your kicks on Route 66.
By 1949, more than 43 million motor vehicles were cruising the nation's highways. Car culture generated its own music, driving lore, and architecture, not to mention cuisine. Greasy spoons, diners, food shacks, and fancy sit-downs.
I like to eat, and no matter what it is, I like to eat.
For the quick stop customer, there were the local treats. Springfield, Illinois had cozy dogs, batter-fried hot dogs on a stick, and horseshoes, a concoction of fries, meat, and cheese on an oval plate. Then, the McDonald's brothers had a San Bernardino drive-in with a speedy service system. The rest is history.
Riding along in my automobile, my baby beside me at the wheel. I stole a kiss at the turn of a mile, my curiosity running wild. Cruising and playing the radio, with no particular place to go.
The car had become a status symbol, and car companies came out with a new model every year. Cars with chrome fins and wings that looked like they could rocket right down the highway. Some travelers found Route 66 dangerous. They called the road Bloody 66, and they weren't referring to outlaws like Bonnie and Clyde cruising in their bullet-strewn car. Delbert True runs a small Route 66 museum in Allen Reed, Texas.
There was very little room on either side of the road if you did drop off. And the biggest problem they had, of course, was with the trucks. When they hit the hills, they slowed down, and people who lost patience tried to pull around the trucks. So almost every time we just went out to get the mail or go to town for groceries, we would run into wrecks.
Bloody 66 was bloody in all the states, but it was really terrible in Missouri.
Skip Curtis.
Down by Springfield, Missouri, there's Northview Hill. It's a two-mile drop with three curves in it. I mean, severe curves. No one can see anybody coming from either direction.
When I heard the crash on the highway, I knew what it was from the start. I went to the scene of destruction, and a picture was stamped on my heart. There was whiskey and blood all together, mixed with glass where they lay. Death laid her hand in destruction, but I didn't hear nobody pray. I didn't hear nobody pray, Deborah.
It was a hubbub, you might say, of too little power and too many people and Blood Alley, we called it. You just gritted your teeth and got a hold with both hands and just hoped you made it through. If you got on and got killed, nobody knew the difference except your relative.
Cars were not the only thing that grew up along Route 66. There was a whole world of art, enough to fill several museums, and writing, and one of my favorites, radio. Perhaps the most famous is Orson Welles' The Hitchhiker on CBS Radio in 1941. In this excerpt, Orson Welles tries to escape a shadowy figure who's following his car.
I didn't see him until late next afternoon. I stopped the car at a sleepy little junction when he appeared across the tracks, leaning against a telephone pole. Without thinking, blindly, I started the car across the tracks. He didn't look up at me. He was staring at the ground. I stepped on the gas hard, bearing the wheel sharply toward him. I could hear the train in the distance now, but I didn't care then. Something went wrong with the car. The train was coming closer. I could hear its bell ringing and the cry of its whistle. Still, he stood there. And now I knew that he was beckoning me to my death.
The clearest radio for those living on and driving Route 66 was from south of the border, where the signal was strong and regulations weak. Poet Simon Ortiz.
My family comes from the Acoma Pueblo Reservation, west of Albuquerque. We had radios that were battery-powered. I remember me and my brother in the early 1950s would listen to radio stations from Del Rio, Texas, and it was like a signal coming from Mars.
From coast to coast, border to border, wherever you are, wherever you may be, when you think of real fine entertainment, think of XERF.
XERF broadcast from Villa Acuna, Mexico, where regulations were lax on what could be sold over the air. Paul Callinger was one of the announcers.
They had heard that I was the one that did this, that I sold an autographed picture of the Lord Jesus Christ, but that I've never done. However, we sold the Lord's Last Supper tablecloth.
On Route 66, XERF made the career of Wolfman Jack, born Bob Smith of Brooklyn. He arrived in the midst of a labor management dispute. The station owed a sizable debt to the Mexican government and back pay to its workers. Smith, realizing XERF was ripe for new leadership, snatched the opportunity and rallied the DJs. The old boss vowed revenge.
So we put barricades all around the station, and we set up a 30-millimeter machine gun and everything to protect the radio station, because it was like 10 miles outside the town of Villa Acuña. And even during the daytime and nighttime, I mean, there was just desolation. It looked like this radio station was sitting in the middle of the Mojave Desert or something, you know?
Everything went fine. Bob Smith became Wolfman Jack, and the workers, pleased with their new boss, let up on their security.
Then all of a sudden, one morning at 5 o'clock in the morning, here they come over the hill, just as the sun was starting to rise, and they hit the radio station with about 60 guys on horsebacks and jeeps and everything. And I was in Del Rio, staying at the Del Rio Hotel with Wolf Woman. I hadn't seen her in a long time, and we were in there making love, and I was listening to the radio at the same time. And he broke in on the reverend's message, yelling, "Pistoleros!" And you hear the bully going, ping, pang, turning around the station. So I jumped in my Starfire Oldsmobile convertible and boogied across the border, spreading $100 bills all over the place. I got the sheriff and guys in garbage trucks riding scooters. And just as we arrived, the sun was just coming up. And here we come over the hill in the horizon, shooting our guns and whooping and howling. And they saw us coming, and we chased them off.
Going 100 miles an hour down the blue asphalt line, listening to the Wolfman of Del Rio.
He never said, "I'm black" or anything else, but he come on, he talked the soul language, just like the Black Brothers, and he become famous.
Marvin Gaye! My man Marvin, baby!
In the mid-50s on Route 66, as Wolfman Jack began a career in border radio, novelist Jack Kerouac captured the lure of travel in On the Road.
My first ride was a dynamite truck with a red flag, about 30 miles into Great Green, Illinois. The truck driver pointing out the place where Route 6, which we were on, intersects Route 66 before they both shoot west for incredible distances.
The road was more than a passage to the west or Midwest. It became one of life's true escapes.
It was drizzling and mysterious at the beginning of our journey. I could see it was all going to be one big saga of mist. "Ooh-wee," yelled Dean. "Here we go." And he hunched over the wheel and gunned her. He was back in his element, anybody could see. We were all delighted. We all realized we were leaving confusion and nonsense behind and performing our one and pure, noble function of the time. Move. The purity of the road, the white line in the middle of the highway, unrolled and hugged our left front tire as if glued to our groove.
Rose Olsendiel.
Kerouac is a male image of freedom. If you're a woman, it has a very different meaning. The road to a woman can be danger, it can be challenge, but it's not Kerouac.
Americans are part of a universal story.
Dick Etalane.
And if you want to go back as far as Homer and to talk about the Odyssey, if you want to think about Cervantes' Don Quixote, or even in our own culture, if you want to think about Grapes of Wrath or Jack Kerouac's On the Road, we've been entranced with going from there to here and to the out there. Route 66 is all of those, and it's a rich, movable feast.
In the 1950s, as Kerouac was being published, others were writing, and their work reflected the perspective of those standing by and living by the road rather than passing in a cloud of dust. Creek poet Joy Harjo grew up near Route 66 in Tulsa from a family half Irish and half Creek. Her work negotiates the distance between these cultures.
You're hit with it from the time you're born. What I saw growing up was blonde hair and blue eyes valued above Indianness, and the darker you were, the more difficult it was for you. It's like a gift of fire, a gift that you can burn your house down or you can use the fire to cook your dinner. And I've decided to let it be my strength rather than to let it destroy me.
Beneath a sky blurred with mist and wind, I am amazed as I watch the violet heads of crocuses erupt from the stiff earth after dying for a season. As I have watched my own dark head appear each morning after entering the next world to come back to this one amazed.
Joy Harjo reading from her work.
I heard about it in Oklahoma or New Mexico, how the wind howled and pulled everything down in a righteous anger.
Realizing America's passion with the car, producer Herbert Leonard created a series called Route 66 in 1960, starring myself, Martin Milner, and George Maharis.
The car was our spaceship, so to speak. It was the Long Ranger's horse. It was the wagon trains. It was Buck Rogers' ship. It was the vehicle. And it represented youth, and it represented a certain mobility. The Corvette had power. It had speed, it was a little dangerous, and it could go.
The actors played two young friends whizzing around the country in a different Corvette each season. The idea was for everybody to rediscover the United States through our characters' eyes. Route 66 was symbolic. It represented the spirit of movement and adventure in the country.
Todd says if we keep moving, we'll find a place to plant roots and stick. With me, it's fine. Just moving.
The TV show ran for 4 years, shot everywhere but Route 66, except for episodes in Chicago. It didn't slow the steady extinction of Route 66. Impressed by the German Autobahn, in 1956, President Dwight Eisenhower had set in gear the construction of a massive 42,000-mile interstate system that would allow Americans more convenient and efficient travel. Tom Teague, author of Searching for 66.
When the interstates came along, the great agent of progress, Route 66, became a victim of progress. And when people didn't have to stop in East St. Louis anymore, they didn't. When people didn't have to stop in San Juan, New Mexico anymore, they didn't. And some of this is good. Cars are built a lot better now. They don't need the same amount of attention. And so that great economic engine pretty much collapsed. And what's left now is a cultural artery. And I think that it will, in time, be ranked with such other great American roads and trails as the Santa Fe Trail, the Oregon Trail. And it probably even higher than them because it affected more people over a greater period of time.
By the late 1950s, bits and pieces of the old road had been replaced. Bypasses were constructed, and the old highway was set aside as a service road. The interstate, costing tens of billions of dollars, took 24 years to build. As it spread across the country, business people along Route 66 regarded it like the Black Plague. In many cases, its effects were as quick and vicious. No exit ramps meant no business.
September 22nd, 1978, between 1 and 2 o'clock.
Angel Delgadillo remembers the day the road closed outside his barber shop in Seligman, Arizona.
There was 9,000 automobiles going through here some days, like during the summer. And suddenly, you could go lie on the street and nobody would run over you because there wasn't any traffic. The only reason we were able to hang on is because we were established business people. We were not paying rent for our businesses, so we hung on. But 10 years is a long time to literally be forgotten by the world, believe me. You don't know what it is to be forgotten by the world. You don't know.
In 1984, one last stretch in Williams, Arizona, was eradicated.
As it got closer to the completion of the interstate out there, I think people got a little bit more and more antsy.
John Holst.
The day that it did happen, it was an incredible change. It went from the traffic being nonstop past the front of this building, just an ear-splitting crush of traffic, constantly slamming and banging and jake brakes. The last stoplight between Chicago and L.A. was right out in front of the building here. And so the day that the bypass came about, there was this incredible quiet, the stillness about town after the celebration that we had with the opening of the interstate and the sending off of Route 66 into a new phase, really the memory stage rather than the active stage of its life.
It took five, not one, interstate highways to replace Route 66. With the removal of the highway markers, it was official. The mother road had been eclipsed.
Ever since they built the freeway, the old two lanes closing down. Cause it winds along the riverbed past too many little towns. They're closing up the truck stop, they had to lock the door. The business can't keep up with the fast food anymore. It's gone the way of Corton, gone the way of the Model T. It's gone the way of the way life used to be. Shopkeeper will suffer, cause no one wants to drive the half mile off the exit ramp to sample local style.
They'll never find the barber, the store or the bakery, lest they get off the big road to see the scenery. It's gone the way of the drive-in, gone the way of the Dynafloat. It's gone the way of the way life used to go.
Some places, the only evidence Route 66 ever existed lies in the rounded curve of a building, a stoic neon sign, or the hulk of an abandoned gas station.
I hope what we have, we keep.
Bob Moore, editor of Route 66 magazine.
I don't want to see a whole lot of major restoration going on. Maybe of the road surface itself so people can travel it. Time moves along, and with time, we lose things. The Coral Court Motel in St. Louis. These things disappear, and that's part of it. That's part of life. That's part of the continuation of what happens to the road. I don't want to see everything preserved, because pretty soon it starts looking like it's all sitting there in saran wrap and you don't want to go near it because it's just too preserved. I like the little rough edges around it. I want to see it stay that way.
Route 66 lives on. The old road can be found in every one of the 8 Route 66 states.
The serious roadie is the man or woman that really wants to find the highway. They want to experience every mile they can find of the old road. That's what the roadie is a person that is willing to put up with a motel where the rooms are a little bit smaller than they are in the big chains. You better shower before 8 because hot water is going to be gone, you know. They're willing to go in the cafes along the road and put up with a little extra grease.
In many places, the Route 66 signs are returning. There are still cafes where the cook in the kitchen bakes the pies.
Now there's people who hanker after an experience they no longer seem to have very easily, which is that now everything has been prepackaged and preordained and pre-digested for you.
Rye Cooter.
That's the trouble with the fast food chains. It used to be on the road, you find a little orangeade stands, you get your orange drink. Some little hot dog place, you get your hot dog. Then down the road, you get something else. Now, of course, we understood Howard Johnson's, and then the rest of them started these chains. And the idea was get the same food every time. They hit upon this idea, and it's terrible. And people get so sick of that. Now, they're confronted with this all the time. The food's going to taste the same, no matter where you're going to. You know that. So where's the adventure? Where's the fun? Where's the sense of discovery? In my childhood, we used to go, and it always seemed to me to be a great adventure because you didn't know what was down the road. And this is what people like as surprises. They like to have something happen to them. And it seems one of the best ways is get in a car and drive somewhere.
For the most part, where the pavement remained, the people remained. And although there are places without historic markers, there is always somebody who remembers.
Well, my time went so quickly, I went lickety-splickly out to my old 55. As I pulled away slowly, feeling so holy, God knows I was feeling alive. Now the song
today, Route 66 museums, associations, newsletters, magazines, souvenirs, and fan clubs are a testament to the road's enduring popularity. In 1999, Congress approved legislation to provide $10 million for preserving historic sites along the route, though it hasn't yet appropriated the money. Route 66. It's the pleasure of driving, motion, a sense of freedom that draws us to all corners near and distant. 66 was just one of the ways home, but as a nation, it's one we love. What remains of Route 66 isn't so much a place, but an idea. The road, transcendent, is truly a highway, stretching clear across the country's imagination. What does Route 66 mean to you?
Well, it's a lot of memories. The spirit of 66, it just represented just dreams to people, dreams of a better life.
It's a road to get to my place of business, but it really is important because it's history.
Really, Route 66 was just its own world, and that possibly could be why some of the mysticism is there. Just all of a sudden, you decided to go somewhere. What did you do? You go jumped in that main vein, and you just let it take you.
It was just part of my childhood. Route 66 was in my backyard. We called it the old Chicago Road. My great-great-grandfather took livestock to Chicago on what was really probably Indian trails and stock trails. It was the shortest distance between two points.
Route 66 is not just a name. Route 66 is an era. Route 66 is it's a community. It's a way of doing things. It's where hardy individualism met grassroots community spirit.
I've seen all the old cars I've never seen before, so then I knew I'm on Route 66. Look at that! Oh, that's tight!
It's unfiltered water, it's bad mattresses, it's sometimes bad food.
And it's a part of tourism, and it's a part of cultural memory, and it's a part of history. And all of those are there in the Route 66 story.
Route 66, it's not just a long stretch of asphalt, it's a mythical thing. It's where the country made the great exodus from the Dust Bowl to a promised land.
It's heaven to me when this starts to cool off and I see the temperatures in the paper going down. I have a little teardrop aluminum trailer and I hitch that thing up and we get out there, and it's a realm of peace and stillness and solitude that's just magic.
It's just kind of resetting the mindset from email and internet and pagers and all that stuff to a whole different way of handling life.
It was a way west. The world is looking for a slower pace of life. And Route 66 gives you that.
Across the Tracks, a Route 66 story, was directed and produced by David Dunaway at the University of New Mexico. It was engineered by Eric Larson and written by Whitney Woodward and David Dunaway. Associate producers were Leslie Rutkowski, Amberly Piles, Dennis Lensing. Additional assistants from Holly Jones, Michelle Fisher, Julie Kunico, Amanda Johnson, Lauren Krenzel, and Rachel Moray. This program was funded by the National Endowment for the Humanities and its state councils in Arizona, California, New Mexico, Texas, Oklahoma, and Illinois. I'm Martin Milner. For all of us, thanks for listening.
For copies of this series, call 505-277-4438 or online unm.edu/RT66. For a companion volume, Across the Tracks, visit booklocker.com or call 505-277-4438. Support for this program comes from this station and Public Radio International stations nationwide. It's made possible in part by the PRI Program Fund, whose contributors include the MacArthur Foundation.